Hello and welcome to the AmBOSS podcast, Beyond the Textbook. Every 2 weeks, experts from AmBOSS, the medical education platform, interview medical students and healthcare professionals to showcase international perspectives on everything in medical school and beyond the textbook. Hello and welcome to the AmBOSS podcast, Beyond the Textbook. We're your hosts today, Dr. Tanner Schrank and my co-host, Sophie Neal. In this episode, we'll be exploring the interactions between humans and artificial intelligence in the world of healthcare with our expert guest, Dr. Anna-Katharine Kleine.
Thanks a lot for having me.
But before we get to that, we'll start with our AmBOSS Question Bank question of the day. Stay tuned until the end to find out the answer, along with our book recommendation and a medical fun fact. So here's your AmBOSS QBank question of the day. From the study plan covering 200 concepts that appear in every Step 2 exam in the Social Sciences Medical Law and Ethics section, your question is, a 36-year-old man comes to the physician because of a 2-week history of productive cough, weight loss, and intermittent fever. He recently returned from a 6-month medical deployment to Indonesia. He appears tired. Physical exam shows non-tender, enlarged, palpable cervical lymph nodes. An X-ray of the chest shows right-sided hilar lymphadenopathy. A sputum smear shows acid-fast bacilli. A diagnosis of pulmonary tuberculosis is made from PCR testing of the sputum. The patient requests that the physician does not inform anyone of this diagnosis because he's worried about losing his job. Which of the following is the most appropriate initial action by the physician? Your answer options are A. Inform the local public health department of the diagnosis. B. Request the patient's permission to discuss the diagnosis with an infectious disease specialist. C. Assure the patient that his diagnosis will remain confidential. D. Confirm the diagnosis with a sputum culture. E. Notify all of the patient's household contacts of the diagnosis. And stick around until the end when we tell you the answer to that question.
So now for our interview, and as we mentioned today, we'll be talking exclusively about the intersection between AI and healthcare. So with AI being an incredibly hot topic at the moment in general, when it comes to healthcare, this is definitely something that we wanted to explore further. Now, although artificial intelligence was first referenced in the 1950s, it wasn't until the early 2000s that many of the limitations were overcome in incorporating this technology into the medical world. Nowadays, with AI being applied to clinical practice through risk assessment models to improve diagnostic accuracy, we seem to have entered a new age of medicine. However, medicine, of course, isn't all data and diagnosis, and the personal touch and human connection between patient and professional still plays an impactful and important role, which is something that we'll also cover in today's episode. So without further ado, we would like to welcome once again our wonderful guest today, Dr. Anna-Katharine Kleine. Anna is a postdoctoral researcher at LMU Munich, currently working on a sponsored program called Human-AI Interaction in Healthcare, Identifying Factors Contributing to Clinical Utility. So thank you so much again, Anna, for joining us. And would you like to start maybe by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure, Sophie. Thanks a lot for having me. Really cool to be on the podcast. I also listened to some of the other episodes and I was really excited to now also join one of them myself. So yeah, I work at the University of Munich in the Human AI Interaction Group. And I think what brought me there was kind of course, like this course into science in general. So during my master's, I kind of discovered that I really like to work as a scientist. So I like to combine different skill sets, like organizing projects, but also finding people really interested in a specific topic and then working together on something, creating something, but also like learning from the knowledge other people have already gained. And then I got into very different topics. So I went into my PhD with more an organizational focus. So I really focus a lot on organizational behavior, more like looking at companies and how they're structured and people working within companies. And then I actually took a little bit of a turn. So I did a data science bootcamp, which was really super interesting. It kind of brought me a little bit closer to this ML AI topic and like really interacting with these different techniques and also learning what they can actually tell us about science and how they can advance science. And then this combination with the medical field, with healthcare, was kind of obvious to me because it's really like one field where AI can advance so much. If it gets close to people, if it can actually create something, it really helps people in a direct sense. So it was something that really fascinated me. And then I found this postdoctoral position. So we've already completed some projects on human AI interaction and the attitudes towards AI in the medical field. But we're also planning new projects and trying right now to also get more output to the public, like to really invite people to get to know more about what AI can do in healthcare and to also invite students to learn more about that, because it will definitely be there for the coming years.
That's really interesting to hear. You've been in so many different directions. And I always think that's really important to explain, because so many people, especially at university, are thinking, well, which route am I going to go in? How do I know which path to follow? And I think the answer is you always go in different directions until you get to exactly where you want to go, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You kind of touched on the different interactions of AI and humans already. And you also mentioned ML, so machine learning. And I'm interested to hear about what drew you towards AI and machine learning in healthcare and seeing how it can be used.
So I would really say it's about this AI, something that hasn't really been there. It's really just being explored during the recent years. So I think like really this new kind of add-on it brings to healthcare and these new ways it can help clinicians to do their care, like to be good carers for their patients. I think that is something that really excites me a lot. And that is also something that hasn't really been explored a lot, especially from this viewpoint of really seeing how they interact with the systems, like not only how the systems are developed and whether they work, but also who's willing to use them and who's willing to use them efficiently, and how can we actually guarantee to patients that the AI tools that are being used are safe and are efficient and are really helping them.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, and I'm particularly interested in how you're looking really at the psychology behind it, you know, rather than just a kind of machine learning or just like an entity that's doing something. You know, you're looking at how it intersects with people and how they will interact with it. And in a patent review from earlier this year, you took an in-depth look at how AI tools are used in the field of psychiatry to diagnose mental disorders and provide treatment recommendations. So as of now, what would you say is the current state of AI use in healthcare?
I think it depends a lot on what you look at. So if you look at the development of AI tools, there's a new tool being developed every day, or even every minute, every hour, there are new tools coming out there. But if we look at the implementation of these tools, I would say we are still at an early stage, especially in some medical fields more than others. So for example, in the patent review, we focused a lot on like mental health care, so psychiatry. And we found over 200 patents that cover clinical decision support tools that aid clinicians with making diagnoses and also deriving treatment recommendations. But when we looked at the actual products that are out there and that are marketed, that are currently used by clinicians, we only found like about 10 products that are out there that are actually in use right now that are regulated by the FDA or that are CE marked. So that was one of the prerequisites for this product view, to really also look at the regulation side of things. And if you look at the products that are regulated and in use, we see a very early stage, especially for the field of, for example, mental health care. And that's a bit different for other domains, like, for example, radiology, we are much further advanced. I think that's also because radiology uses different data. So they use x-rays, like data from x-ray CT scans. So this data is kind of structured, and it's easier for AI algorithms to make sense of that data, in contrast to, for example, data for mental health care, where it's a lot about behavior observations, personal interviews. That's very difficult to handle by AI tools.
It really depends on the area of medicine that you're looking at. And I think even from a human perspective, if you look at mental health, it's harder to deal with data from a human perspective than it is, as you said, maybe radiology. So I think definitely when it comes to mental health with AI, I was expecting you to say that there's a long way to go there.
Yeah. And I think it also depends a bit on the task, right? So is it just about like streamlining administrative tasks in healthcare? Is it about medication management? I think those things are less controversial than, for example, deriving diagnoses or deriving treatment recommendation. Because what if the AI is wrong? So who's liable actually for the AI decision? I think there are also fields or applications that are more controversial and more difficult, and therefore also at an earlier stage than others.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. AI speeds up administrative tasks like transcribing notes from an encounter with a patient. But then you can tie that to like a recording.
Yeah.
And you can always double check that. But if the AI is doing something that's very subjective, like taking a psychiatric interview and then diagnosing them or suggesting treatments, that's where it's really surprising to me that people would be okay with that, or that it can actually do that.
Yeah, I think also one important point about that is it doesn't really fully do that, right? So it's just like right now it's only used as an aid to the clinician. So it doesn't take over that role as a clinician. It doesn't do the decision making entirely. So the clinician can use the tool as an aid to making a diagnosis.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm ready to be fully treated by an AI doctor yet.
I think it's also just not the idea, right? Being treated by an AI doctor. Nobody really wants it.
No, it's definitely a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
You also performed a study on this, on the adoption of AI by psychotherapists and their attitudes towards it. Are physicians and medical students aware of these AI tools at their disposal and the ethical considerations of it? Like we just talked about how you can use it as an aid in your diagnosing, but, you know, there's even doctors who use faxes. So like, it's very hard for me to believe that they would be using AI in the patient encounter. And if they're fully thinking through what it means that I'm depending on this robot basically to help me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there again, it depends a lot on the field. So we did that study with psychology students and psychotherapists in training. And I think again, in like mental health care, it's very much at the very early stage. So many of the participants of our study have never really heard of those tools. We see a totally different picture if we look at, for example, radiology and medical students. So I think they're definitely acquainted with some of the tools that are out there and could be used. It's a little bit unclear, I think, how many of them already use those tools and would be ready to use them. And I think it's a totally different point also saying that they understand the tools and can really communicate also to patients what the tools do and create that trust also from the patient side in the decision making that's aided by AI tools. So I think, again, it's a little bit about the task and also being acquainted with it or fully understanding the tool and what it actually does, how the recommendation is generated.
It's like anything else, right? There's a learning curve. You're not just instantly an expert on it or know everything about it.
Yeah. But I think knowing like a little bit about it and really being educated about the basics of how AI recommendations are generated, I think that should be an integral part of medical studies and also in psychology. So people need to get acquainted with these ideas and they need to understand them at least a little bit so they can trust the tools themselves. I think that's the first point, but then also communicate their trust to patients to kind of explain how they're making their decisions so patients can also trust their decision making.
Yeah. So that actually brings me to my next question, which you already touched upon. How have you seen AI opening doors in mental health care and how can that interaction be improved?
Yeah, so I think the first tools we see right now that are really also publicly available on the internet to clinicians are tools that are, for example, diagnosing ASD, using things like eye tracking data, also interview data, like really trying to observe, for example, children interacting and then diagnosing ASD. So that is, I think, one of the first fields where this is actually advancing a bit more. Then also things like sleep disorders using EEG data, like really tracking down sleep disorders, seeing why people don't sleep well, have insomnia. So these are tools that we see right now that are already out there and can be used.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Obviously, these are all very positive steps forward. But on the other side of that, I was wondering what you see as some of the main risks of using AI in healthcare.
Yeah, so I would say one of the main risks is maybe not understanding the limitations of AI. So really understanding that AI is a tool. It's not a replacement of a medical professional judgment. So really, we also see in some studies that, for example, clinicians are just too easily accepting AI advice. They always go with the AI advice and they make a mistake because of that. I think that's something we don't really want. So AI still makes mistakes and clinicians need to be able to see when they actually have to check the AI advice again. So also this critical lens, I think that should always be there. And also not forgetting the patient and also understanding that AI is only as good as the data that is used to create it. So of course, AI recommendations are created using certain data. And if that data is biased, so for example, there's a lot of homogeneity in the data, so it's only one sort of people that are always tested, and then that data is used to generate the AI recommendation, then also the recommendation is biased. And if I see other people, people with different features, then the tool might not work as well.
That's a really, really good point to make, because for me, the concept of using AI is quite new, because I've been out of work on maternity leave, and I've kind of come back, I feel like, to a whole new world. And I think a lot of it is, as you just said, in the understanding of how something works or how you ask questions or what data is being used.
Yeah. And I don't really know if it has to be the clinician who judges that. Maybe there's a person in the middle who's kind of then referring the tool to the clinician. I think that's more realistic, really.
That's so interesting to me, the different ways that it's already being used. And I would like to look into the future, what you think the AI tools are going to be used for in healthcare in like the next 10 years. Because you mentioned like diagnosing autism spectrum disorder based on the patterns you see in the patient encounter, or looking at EEG data for sleep disorders. Do you think it's going to be more of like processing this giant amount of raw data? Or is it going to be more like this patient is matching this pattern? They might have autism or they might have ADHD.
Yeah, actually, I think one thing that really excites me about these tools and their possibilities is this personalized medicine aspect. So not only being able to say, okay, you have depression, but to actually leverage the power that AI gives us and to really say, hey, what is actually depression? We might have a spectrum of depression and humans are not very good at detecting different nuances on that spectrum. But using like multiple data sources or using very advanced AI algorithms to kind of say, okay, you might have this sort of depression, and then deriving certain treatment recommendations for these specific groups. I think that's something super exciting because it will definitely lead to better care for patients, but it might also take away stigma, right? So if we say, okay, you don't really have depression, you have this sort of depression and another person has this sort. And I think that's really kind of taking the stigma of certain diseases or disorders away a little bit.
That's super exciting. And I think that ties into something that you already said, too. You mentioned biases. If the data set that the AI is based on is biased in some way, then the results are going to be biased. A classic example is like lupus. So one of the characteristic symptoms of lupus is a rash on the face. But most of the textbook images we have are of white people. So even though it affects people with dark skin, we don't have great examples of it to teach students. Mm-hmm. And so the AI is going to have this blind spot. But at the same time, I really like this idea of the personalized approach to maybe take away those biases. Because if the clinician maybe is less willing to acknowledge a woman's symptoms rather than a man's, then the AI can be trained to look at both of them equally and say, well, she has depression. Take it seriously, because the AI doesn't necessarily have to have the same gender prejudices or biases, because we can engineer it.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, in that sense, it might be a bit more objective, maybe, than some people are. So yeah. I think really interacting with it, I think, is a good idea, because we also need this subjectivity and this empathy of humans, but maybe adding some of the objectivity of AI.
I really think that could transform a lot of these issues in medical practice, yeah. Do you see any other areas where it could maybe enhance patient care or medical practice?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I think is pretty obvious these days is, for example, detecting huge virus outbreaks or detecting diseases that affect many people before they actually happen. I think that's also super exciting and could be better done using AI tools.
Yeah, finding the signal among the noise. Like, is there a malaria outbreak or is this just normal for this time of year? That's really interesting too.
Wow, that's really interesting. Based on your research, you said you're more in that area of mental health and psychology. How do you see your research applying within the field of medical education?
Well, not so much. So I think there's definitely a blind spot. I mean, I see that a lot with psychology students. So they haven't sometimes even heard about certain tools. So they might all use ChatGPT, but they don't really know about the possibilities of AI for healthcare, also for their care they might be delivering in the future. So I think like educating students about the tools that are out there and also educating them about how they can educate themselves to use the tools, I think, yeah, that is definitely key. And that shouldn't be only focused to data science courses. It should also be integrated into the curriculum of medical students, of psychology students.
That's a really good answer. Just actually, first of all, starting off with the basics of educating people as to what's out there. How can you use it? How can you educate yourself? And you're organizing an upcoming festival for medical and psychology students to talk more about this topic. And I believe you mentioned there might be a podcast as well.
Yeah, right. Thanks for bringing that up. So yeah, there will be like a science festival that we're planning for next year, where we will actually try to bring the clinicians, tool developers, but also students together to discuss like the different biases, advantages, disadvantages, questions they have also to developers and practicing clinicians about the benefits and disadvantages also of using AI. So yeah, it will be like an interactive festival. So I really wanted to not have it as a scientific only conference, but really like a festival where different stakeholders, but also students can come together and kind of learn from each other and get different perspectives. Maybe also try out like different tools and see how the recommendations are actually generated to show them, hey, what's out there? What can you maybe use in the coming years? And we also wanted to have a podcast around that. So some podcast episodes before the festival. Also, of course, to raise attention for the festival, but also there to discuss how AI is used in different medical fields. Because as I just said, there's huge differences between AI for cardiology, for oncology, and for mental health. So of course, like the different stages, but also the use cases and the risks and biases that are involved.
That sounds really cool. And it sounds like the perfect opportunity for you to try and fill that gap, right, of educating mm-hmm. students as to what is out there and how they can use it. And I think it's going to be a really exciting festival. I know you said it's in early stage planning, so I don't know if there's any way that students can find out about the podcast or how to listen to it. We can drop it into a future episode for anyone who might be interested to listen.
Oh, that would be super cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, if anyone is interested, then just keep listening and we will keep you updated on that as soon as we get more information. I wanted to finish up with you, Anna, with our final, very important question. If you could give our listeners today any advice beyond the textbook.
Yeah, I think I would really say embrace the technology. Yeah, but maintain perspective. I think that what I would really say about using AI in healthcare. So I think it brings definitely a lot of potential, like using AI for delivering help, for kind of improving diagnosis making, treatment and overall care, but still don't lose sight of the human aspect of AI in healthcare. So it's not only about the AI tool, but it's about how I interact with the tool. It can only complement, but it cannot really substitute things like talking with people, human interaction, empathy, intuition. So to really keep an eye on that and also be sure that you and your role as a clinician will always be needed. And also definitely understand what AI can do and can't do. Like be aware of biases, be aware of data quality, be aware of the limitations and try to use it like responsibly mm-hmm. and also in a safe way. So educate yourself about how you use the tool properly and then do it accordingly.
It's really great yeah. advice, I think.
Nice.
Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. A huge thank you again to you, Dr. Kleiner, for taking the time to join us. We've been so happy to have you here today.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Now let's go back to that AMBOSS question bank question of the day and give you the answer. First, your key info from the question was a diagnosis of pulmonary TB and the patient requesting that the physician not inform anyone of his diagnosis. Now your attending tip would be, physicians have an ethical and legal obligation to keep a patient's medical information confidential. There are, however, exceptions that relate to the imminent health and safety of the patient and or the public. Now, with that in mind, which answer would you choose? Hopefully, you chose answer A, inform the local public health department of the diagnosis. And the AMBOSS explanation of this answer is that although a physician is ethically and legally obligated to keep medical information confidential, there are exceptions to confidentiality, including notifiable diseases with public health implications, such as tuberculosis. This patient is newly diagnosed with pulmonary TB and poses an infectious risk to the general public. Therefore, disclosure of the diagnosis and other pertinent information, for example, drug susceptibility testing, to the public health department is necessary. Some local health departments will investigate close contacts for potential referral for evaluation and treatment. To learn more about this, check out the Principles of Medical Law and Ethics section in the AMBOSS platform and find out more questions like this in the study plan covering 200 concepts that appear in every USMLE Step 2 exam. So our medical fun fact for our listeners is, despite what some medication advertisements claim, there is no evidence that mental illnesses are caused by a chemical imbalance of neurotransmitters such as serotonin. So definitely need to read up more about that chapter in AMBOSS to get a better understanding of what causes these mental illnesses. And your book recommendation is Epic Measures, One Doctor, 7 Billion Patients by Jeremy Smith from 2015. It's a gripping exploration into Dr. Christopher Murray's unparalleled global health data revolution, offering invaluable insights into human health and longevity. So check it out.
Well, that's it for our episode today of the AMBOSS podcast, Beyond the Textbook. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast for more insightful episodes covering everything in healthcare and medical education. I'm Sophie Neal.
And I'm Dr. Tanner Schrank.
And this has been AMBOSS Beyond the Textbook.
The links in the description can give you a more in-depth understanding of these concepts. If you like this episode, please give us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. You can check out the AMBOSS platform for your medical studies and sign up for a free 5-day trial at AMBOSS.com.